From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. 15 years of forever wars, religious divisions which threatened to further inflame the civil war in Ukraine, a retrospective on former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, and the Trump media log rolling. Those are some of the headlines on this week's ConsortiumNews.com, and we spoke with Executive Editor Joe Loria via Skype from Washington, D.C., late Tuesday. Let's start with the banner, 15 Years of Forever Wars.
Yeah, that's a piece that I put up last night. It's actually a speech given back in May by Chas Friedman, former Ambassador Chas Friedman, who was one of our most lucid voices in Washington about American foreign policy. Mm. And basically, he looks back, and I hadn't realized this, that on May 1st, 2003, there were two speeches made that day, one in Kabul by Don Rumsfeld, the then Secretary of Defense, who said that Afghanistan had now been stabilized and basically the war was over.
Right.
And we had Bush on that very same day landing on the USS Abraham in this unbelievable PR stunt where he supposedly flew the plane in and got out and took his flight suit off and announced that mission was accomplished.
Right.
War in Iraq's over. So on the same day, May 1, 2003, Rumsfeld and Bush said these two wars are over. And the Afghan war started in 2001,
right.
October, I believe,
yep.
or November. And now it's 2018. So we're going on to 17 years, the longest war, blah, 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 in American history. And the Iraq war, which, okay, there's a much smaller number of U.S. troops there, but it is not a completely stabilized country by any means. I had lived there for 2 years, just up until last year.
Right.
So look, these wars are going on. And I think clearly that not only were they lying back then, saying that everything was stabilized or seriously mistaken, take your choice.
Right.
That I think the intentions of the neoconservatives are to keep these wars going. They're not intended to be won. They're intended, in my opinion, and I'm only making this a judgment based on what I've seen over these 17 years, is that the purpose of these wars is to keep countries that can cause trouble to the U.S. in terms of its geo strategy in the Middle East or elsewhere, to keep these countries divided and killing one another, and then they're no longer any danger to Israel or to the U.S. interests in the region.
Right.
And there's a whole lot of hell of a contract money to be made, as we saw in Iraq
right.
and Afghanistan and anywhere else. So the money keeps flowing in, and the countries remain at odds with each other, killing one another, destabilized, terrorism continues, and the U.S. is saying we're still fighting for freedom and against terrorism, when, of course, they backed what became the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, and Russia went in to stop ISIS in Syria and al-Qaeda, and they're the ones who are the problem, as we heard from Jeremy Hunt today in his speech in Washington, the Foreign Secretary of Britain, that Russia's up to no good in the world and we got to stop them. And, you know, everyone believes this. And if they care about Russia at all, Don, as we saw,
right.
I'm talking about the American people, not the rulers, the bipartisan establishment in the U.S. and in Britain. Certainly, they believe Russia is a big, big threat. Not Corbyn, but certainly the Tories and both parties in the U.S. Russia is a threat, not just in our elections, but also their invasions of Georgia, even though the European Union said that Georgia started that. And then in Syria, even though it's very clear that why Russia went in there, and we now know that that's the case. And John Kerry admitted it in this leaked tape when he spoke to Syrian exiles in New York. And at the end of 2015, he said that he saw the reason Putin went in was to stop ISIS from taking over Syria. This is mm-hmm. more or less a direct quote from Kerry.
Right.
So the Americans knew why Russia did what they did in Syria, but they lied. And the press, which in my opinion is more guilty than the government. We expect government people to lie. They're supposed to lie. They lie. The press is supposed to be there to stop them
right.
from lying, to challenge them,
right.
to protect the American people or other publics from those lies, and they're going right along with that.
I mean, it's worse than that.
This is what's so troubling.
It's worse than that, because the mechanism of the government lying to us isn't some guy from Congress showing up at your front door and lying to you through the screen. They speak in front of a bunch of reporters who are able to ask questions and who don't. And even if you're sitting in front of your television watching one of these press conferences, for example, or looking at the sites from press releases that they received and, you know, over via email or whatever, questions that would occur to you or to a child are not asked at all. And instead, they run interference for them. And that happens so blatantly in front of us, and it's happened so, like, wall-to-wall through the media. And yet people, you know, they wonder why when they poll us, nobody trusts the media.
That's one of the effects. The media is supposed to be, that's right, the entire American public can get into a press conference to ask their question. They're relying on the press to ask the questions for them.
Right.
The media is supposed to be the representative of the people in keeping government and to account. And I disagree with Trump's reasons for saying it. He has different reasons, but I agree that the press, therefore, is the enemy of the American public,
right,
simply because they're not the defender of the American public.
Right.
They, by default, become the enemy. And he's saying that because they're attacking him personally. I mean, who gives a damn? I'm talking about much larger issues that go back way before Trump and will continue after Trump. The media is not representing public's interests, and that is a huge, huge problem. I'll give you an example today. New York Times, David Sanger, Shira Frenkel. The Russian military intelligence unit that sought to influence the 2016 election appears to have a new target, these conservative think tanks. Now,
right,
the military intelligence unit that sought to influence, so the New York Times has tried and convicted these Russian defendants in the pages of the New York Times. Why do we need courts, Don, when we have newspapers? get rid of the justice system.
Right.
We have the newspapers to convict people.
Right.
This is outrageous. This is really, they've lost their, it's the basic 101 principles of journalism, Journalism 101, that someone's accused of a crime, they're not guilty until proven in the court, and they're innocent until proven guilty. That's dispensed with in foreign affairs in general, and in particular on the Russia story.
Let's go back for a second. The statement that Rumsfeld made, we remember Bush standing in front of that huge banner,
right,
mission accomplished, okay, in his flight,
yep,
in his flight jacket. But Rumsfeld said, this is the quote that's in the article, we clearly
yeah,
have moved from major combat activity to a period of stability and stabilization and reconstruction, closed quote.
Reconstruction, yeah.
You know, now, that was May 1st, 2003. Was it the day before yesterday there was a rocket attack on the senior government officials in Kabul and the U.S. Embassy?
So it's a lie. It turns out to have been false. He was wrong, Rumsfeld. I don't remember ever hearing him apologize for that or at least correcting his mistake. Afghanistan has huge resources that I think the U.S. is interested in, minerals, etc. It's a strategic location to Central,
right,
Asia in terms of oil.
Right.
So the U.S. needs to, but they're losing that war. They have lost, basically.
People have been writing for 100 years about this. I mean, if you look at Orwell's 1984, even, that the whole basis of their economy was, you know, to be at constant war, permanent war with each other so that they could consume the resources, keep people whipped up in a patriotic fervor, and have an endless supply of money, basically being focused,
right,
on things that you blow up, which takes care of the supply problem with the capitalist economy. And that's exactly what's happened. We've had massive military budgets after being promised a peace dividend, and nothing to show for it other than an awful lot of really miserable and dead people.
Absolutely. Go back to 1946 and 47. Truman, the Truman administration was terrified because the economy started to tank again when the war ended. They came out of a depression with the war. It seemed like it was going back into one. He made a big deal with the aircraft manufacturers to build more planes. He instituted a draft, the first peacetime draft. He created the Cold War. They created tensions with Soviet Union after the war and built a Cold War out of it, with Churchill's help and a bunch of other people, to want to build up a defense industry that is still the core of so many of our states and so many jobs around the United States. In each of the 50 states, as your listeners well know, there are these defense contracts in every state, so every senator is going to vote for this money that comes through the Defense Department. So that's why the U.S. continuously, leaders keep talking about fighting World War II over and over again. Everybody they want to take out is Hitler, Noriega,
Right.
Saddam.
Right.
Milosevic. And now Putin, as Clinton called him. They're all Hitler, and we're the good guys. And, of course, Americans don't know that it was Russia that won, the Soviet Union that won that war against the Nazis, not the U.S. and Britain.
Right.
They suffered the vast majority of it. But, you know, we take the credit for that. So we're still on the right side of history and spreading democracy. And if you look at that article in the New York Times that I mentioned before, which is so bizarre, not only do they dispense with the word alleged by blaming these Russians and convicting them in the pages of the newspaper, but they go further by then later in the article saying that that this Republican Institute, I'm trying to find it here, that this Republican Institute is spreading democracy around. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, the International Republic Institute, one of the ones that was supposedly hacked by the Russians.
Promoting democracy around the world. Right.
Yeah, has worked for decades in promoting democracy around the world. This was a flat statement in this morning's New York Times.
Yep. It's a statement of fact.
And it is a bald-faced lie.
Right, that's right. That's right. And so
that's a core myth, core part of the American myth. Repeated all the time, and this morning in the New York Times as well.
Yeah, well, here's you got among the board of directors, you've got McCain, Romney, and McMaster.
Yeah. Yep. There you go.
You know,
they're spreading democracy.
Yeah, and they one of the places that they helped spread it was Kiev, by the way, to Ukraine.
That's correct.
They were heavily involved there. They've been heavily involved in spreading democracy in Latin America. They've been trying to spread democracy to Venezuela
Haiti.
For quite some time.
Yeah,
in Haiti, they've brought a lot of democracy. Not much food, though, but a lot of democracy. People there get to eat democracy. So, we see one major problem here, of course. What else is going on in the landscape?
So let's look back at the front page here. We've got...
yes, indeed.
We have another story. I would like to talk about the piece that I rewrote, that I republished, rather, that I wrote in the Boston Globe in 2006.
About Kofi Annan. Yeah, definitely. Let's
of course,
that.
On Saturday, Kofi Annan died at the age of 80. Quite suddenly, he seemed to be in good health. Nobody knew about this. Personally, he was the most engaging Secretary General that I ever covered. I covered four of them.
Yeah, you knew him.
So
right?
I knew.
Yeah,
I knew him quite well.
Yeah,
I'll give you a little small story. I was in Stockholm at a genocide conference, and there I met Samantha Power, by the way, when she was still a journalist. Had a conversation with her, and Kofi Annan attended this conference, and he did a press conference, and I was standing all the way in the back, and I didn't get a chance to ask a question or anything. And about a week later, I'm standing in UN headquarters in the corridor, and Kofi Annan walks by, and he pulls away from his security people, comes up to me to shake my hand and say, "I saw you in Stockholm." Now, this guy is like Bill Clinton. He had that touch, right?
Uh-huh.
He knew how to butter up the press and everybody. Well, he saw me. I didn't know that he even saw me, but he made it. So, yes, I knew the guy. I knew him when he was head of peacekeeping. But on my piece I wrote, which I don't think anybody's taken this angle, and I'm shocked when I read it now that it was in a mainstream newspaper, because my first paragraph ends with the phrase U.S. dominance, that I'm saying that Kofi Annan, the first Sub-Saharan African Secretary General, ends his 10-year term this Sunday. This is back to 2006, leaving behind a complex legacy during an era of genocide, terrorism, and U.S. dominance.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying was that he was pulled in two directions. His whole 10-year tenure was conflicted between doing what the U.S. wanted, because they put him in office. If you recall, Boutros-Ghali, who in my opinion was the most independent after Dag Hammarskjöld, the most independent Secretary General,
right,
because Boutros did not go along with the U.S., and they got it. They kicked him out. They vetoed.
Right,
his re-election. They had to do it.
He's the most independent one that didn't die in a mysterious plane crash, right?
Exactly. He did die a couple of years ago, but it wasn't a mysterious plane crash.
Like Hammarskjöld. Yeah.
Like Hammarskjöld. Yes. So Kofi was torn between, and my article explains how he did things, because he felt indebted. He had to help Africa. He was the first sub-Saharan African Secretary General, and he had to do something to help Africa and other developing countries, but he also owed the U.S., so he was constantly, and the big crisis for the Americans was when the BBC, a BBC interviewer continuously badgered him to answer the question whether the invasion of Iraq in 2003 by the U.S. was illegal or not, and he had to admit it was illegal because it did not have a Security Council authorization, and it was not in self-defense. And those are the only two rules on the UN Charter, on international law, that a nation can go to war. If you're attacked or if you get the council to agree that you need to go to war. Otherwise,
right.
It's illegal. Even if the Congress declared war, it's still,
in
terms of international law, it's illegal. And that's also U.S. law. The U.N. Charter is part of U.S. law. All international law, when ratified by the Senate, becomes U.S. law as well. So my article goes through that. Now, some comments that your listeners can see if they go to the article are saying Coffey was just, you know, the U.N. stooge and all that. Well, I did another article about Ban Ki-moon for Consortium News when he left in 2017. Well, he left at the end of 2016 on New Year's Day, 2017, and he was a complete stooge of the United States. And you can go and read that article in the archives.
Yeah.
Ban Ki-moon is the example of the absolute worst Secretary General, in my opinion.
Right.
I knew him too, and personally, I had no problems with him. I don't think he was corrupt. I think he had good intentions, but he was a complete man of the United States, complete yes man.
Yep.
And there were so many examples of that, particularly on issues with Russia, that he'd always took the U.S. side. So he's from South Korea, obviously, kind of a colony of the United States.
Yeah.
So it's not to be a surprise. He didn't have the same kind of pressures of a constituency that were demanding he stand up to the U.S. like an African, like a sub-Saharan African did. So that Kofi Annan, I think it's worth looking back on him and what's happened to the U.S. But again, I'm surprised that the Boston Globe even ran that, and I wonder if they would today, where I talk about U.S. dominance.
I know, it's amazing. It's really an amazing piece, actually. And just the way it's laid out, because it isn't just a turn of phrase there. I mean, you detail what you mean by it, and you're not in a flattering way. It's not a slanderous way either. It just details factually this U.S. dominance.
Yes,
that was the parameters of operating the United Nations. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. So, what else do we have on the front page?
We've got a piece from
Dmitry Babich, the first article that he ever published on Consortium News, which is a complex piece, took a lot of editing. It was an article we had a long time before we published it, but it's interesting because it gives a different angle to the Ukraine crisis, and the Ukraine civil war.
Yeah,
that isn't often looked at, but it may not be so important to Americans or people who aren't Orthodox Christians or Christians at all, but it has a deep political significance. I mean, you have to understand how important religion is to people in Russia, in post-Soviet Russia, and in Ukraine.
Right.
And in fact, there are a lot of Roman Catholics in the western part of Ukraine who look to the west, but there's also a Ukrainian Orthodox Church that still has the name Moscow in its title, Moscow Patriarch.
Yeah, well, also
and
Kiev.
There was this.
Kiev was the first Russian city.
Well, that's right.
Back. So
important.
The foundation of the church really, comes through Kiev.
Absolutely. It was 1,030 years ago.
Yeah.
In fact, they just celebrated that anniversary on July 30th. That's what gave rise to this peace.
That's right.
That the Ukrainian authorities tried to stop Russians from coming, tried to stop people who don't agree with this breakaway church. And that's what the story is about, that there was a breakaway church established in 1992 by this guy who lost an ecclesiastical election. And then it was right at the Soviet Union's collapse, he decided to create this separate Ukrainian Orthodox Church, apart from this one that has the title Moscow. And even though it's not ruled by Russia, it has its own organization, the Orthodox Church, as the article explains, is not like the Catholic Church, where it has centralized authority in Rome.
Right.
This is decentralized. In many ways, like Islam is decentralized. There's no pope.
Right.
There's no real head of the church. But this guy created this separate church, and it has never been recognized by other Orthodox churches around the world. But now it was always left there to exist, but now it's taking on a huge role because Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, is in league with this guy who started this separate church to try to take over the existing Orthodox church in Ukraine that has the name Moscow in it, that owns millions and maybe billions of dollars worth of property, that they want to take over this property and then make this the only church in Ukraine. So it's a fascinating story and leading to more and more tensions in what's already a very fraught situation in Ukraine, obviously.
Right. That the last thing that they need in Kiev is to have a break among the population over religion, when just about every other identity item is already used to keep the people divided there. Language was the first thing that they attacked.
That's right.
As soon as the Maidan group took, seized power in a coup. The first act of the Rada, the parliament there, was to decertify Russian as one of the official languages, even though more than half the people in the country, in the eastern part of the country, most of the people speak Russian as first language.
Well, that's right. And Dmitry corrected me, because I had thought, because when they did that, there was an outcry, particularly from European governments. So they reversed that decision and reinstated Russian language as. But now, Dmitry's point, I did not know, it just slipped through the cracks that they sometime later, with American backing, they have decertified Russian language again.
Yep, that's right. Yep. Yeah, they moved it down the agenda a couple items, that's all.
That shouldn't have been the first thing they did, like when the Clintons came in and did the gay policy in the midterms. The first thing they did, you remember that?
That's right.
There was an outcry. So this is what the first thing they did. Well, they showed their hand, how anti-Russian they are, and what that was all about, was an anti-Russian coup and an anti-Russian government, et cetera. And we can talk about Ukraine a long time. But this is one aspect that has not gotten any attention. And that's Consortium News is one of its main purposes, is to publish stories that the mainstream media in the United States and in the West ignore. And from a different angle, obviously, even if we publish stories they do publish, we have a completely different angle on it.
So I think we can close with while we're waiting Tuesday afternoon to find out what's happening with Cohen, with Trump's attorney, who's going to be pleading out. Apparently, we're told he's going to be pleading out his case in court late this afternoon. We could talk about Sam Husseini's piece that's on the front page about that spectacle last Thursday, where all these corporate newspapers did a coordinated editorial. That was kind of scary. I hadn't seen anything like that since September 11, 2001, when they all had kind of the same, everything was on the same one channel, or one program was on all channels. This was kind of like that with the editorial pages.
Well, exactly. So Sam took what is obviously an unpopular position in the mainstream, but very popular with our readers, and saying, well, yes, Trump's been horrible, and he deserves a lot of the criticism he's gotten in the media, and his attacks are childish. But let's not forget that the mainstream media has to do a lot of soul searching itself, and that in these editorials, there was no mention of Julian Assange and the possible prosecution of WikiLeaks and Assange. And that is a key, obviously, I think, the most important issue about freedom of the press right now. Because even the New York Times number two lawyer told a group of judges out in California a couple of weeks ago, and Ray McGovern wrote a piece about it for us, that he told them that prosecuting Julian Assange and WikiLeaks is very problematic for the New York Times. Because the Times not only published WikiLeaks leaks back during the Bush administration, when for the Democrats that was great because Assange was exposing Bush and his crimes, but as soon as he exposed Hillary Clinton, then we got to get this guy. But this lawyer, speaking only from a legal point of view, not political, not editorial, saying, listen, we've done the same thing. We also publish classified material all the time. We will in the future. If the United States prosecutes a publisher for doing that, not for stealing the documents, actually, but for just receiving them and publishing them, well, how is that different from what we do? The only difference is he gives the raw material, where we write an article and give our spin.
Right.
So in the old days, the New York Times would actually print a lot more full documents in the papers. For example, the Pentagon Papers, if I recall, whole sections of it were printed over pages inside the New York Times. So it wasn't just the article. They actually gave huge sections of the text. They would always publish the text of a major speech. I don't know if you recall back then, Don.
I did, for sure.
New York Times.
Yeah.
Kind of reams of pages of news, and they would also have whole speeches and things and documents republished, because now they can provide a link online.
Right.
But the point is, WikiLeaks does the same thing the New York Times does, and that's why this is so serious, and why if the editorials were all going to be coordinated like that against Trump, they had to mention other issues. And they never look at themselves, the press. They are, they think they're the defenders of democracy, which we earlier in this conversation laid out that I believe they aren't. And they're the defenders of the establishment. And this is another case. This is an establishment, 300 establishment newspapers supporting an establishment position. And without going anywhere near WikiLeaks, without talking about why Heather Nauert doesn't ask any questions of Russian answer any Russian reporters' questions anymore, or the registration of RT. Now they want Al Jazeera to be registered. All these other issues that the press is involved in is never mentioned in these editorials. So it was just an anti-Trump thing. Right. He deserves a lot of criticism, but you know, so does the press. That's what Sam was saying.
Yeah, he ran through a list of a number of things that this press has no problem with whatsoever. RT and Sputnik, by the way, Al Jazeera and a bunch of others having to register as foreign agents, like you mentioned, and Heather Nauert, not just refusing to take questions from Russian reporters, mocking them on a couple of occasions, as did Jen Psaki and Harf and a whole a whole bunch of them. Some folks that shouldn't be making fun of anybody were doing it that were at the State Department. Yeah. Okay, we can go back to the last administration for that, and also the things that have been happening with social media, particularly egregious in my opinion, is Telesur being banned from Facebook. Telesur is, the most, I would say, the one independent transnational news outlet in the Western Hemisphere, and it's the Central and South American independent press in essence, and Caribbean independent.
That's
press.
Why it needed to be banned.
And they're
that's
banned
why
from
it
Facebook.
To be banned.
Yep.
And you would think it's independent.
That's right. That's exactly the
from the Western point. American point of view. It may not say everything. They may have errors in their reporting and whatnot, but the people need to have a vast array of voices and points of view. And that's all we're asking for here, and not just the establishment Western media point of view, but that's what they're whittling away attempts. They want only the people to listen to what the establishment says, because that reinforces the fact that it's Russia's fault that we have racial divisions in the United States and a growing economic divide, and that they're undermining our democratic institutions, not plutocrats buying the American political system, or long history of racial division, or these 30 years of neoliberal economic policies that are destroying people's lives here and the middle class. No, it's the Russians who are doing it. So they need the media, the central established media, to be pressing that message that the Russian agents are the ones who did it without any kind of a trial. The Times convicts them. That's why they've got to get rid of. Now, they still have their websites, but they could work on that. So little by little, they realize that social media has become the vehicle to present news from websites. Yes, you can still go to the Telesur website, as far as I know, at least this morning, I think. And you can still go to Alex Jones, if that's your cup of tea. It isn't mine, obviously, to go there. But he should have. That's the whole point about censorship. You got to defend the person you dislike the most. Just like ACLU defended those neo-Nazis in Illinois outside Chicago 30, 40, 50 years, stinky. Whatever that was, when they marched.
Yep.
You have to defend, and ACLU today actually came out in defense of Alex Jones. Not Alex Jones, what he's saying, but his right to say it. And this is an unbelievably perilous development, and it's slippery, and we did our second Consortium News, our first Consortium News radio interview with Peter Van Buren, a former State Department official and whistleblower on Iraq, who got into a Twitter war with mainstream reporters over whether or not they support America's war efforts. And only a moron would not see that they don't. Just look at the 2003 invasion of Iraq and the lead up to that. But he made the fatal error. So you've got to be very, very careful online, because if you say the slightest thing that gives them a chance to get you on their so-called community standards, they will.
Right. Snip
he ended
out.
One
That's
very right. rational argument with some reporter, some mainstream reporter, by saying, I hope somebody, a guy wearing a MAGA hat, eats your face.
Right. And that was enough.
When he crossed that line,
that's
that
right.
Was it.
That was
it. You got to be really careful. Same as Caitlin Johnstone.
Yep.
She went over the line by saying she thought the world would be an improved place when John McCain dies. That's not even, so that was enough for Twitter to suspend her.
That's right.
But only for a day. Van Buren has been deleted. His whole 7 years of tweets have been deleted, and he's permanently banned from Twitter.
And meanwhile, the assembled corporate press were able to lie, in essence, for a year, two, 3 years, and create a war in Iraq where none should have, and a million or better people died, and nothing. All right, we got to get out of here. We're out of time. Joe, thank you. We'll speak with you again next week. Keep on keeping on.
Thank you, Don. All the best.
Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.